All right, and now we're ready to begin. Our first talk this morning is, I've seen it a couple times, several actually, is a fabulous talk. And we alluded to it for those of you who were here for the 101 course about reservoirs. And our speaker is Dr. Bob Silicano, who's at Johns Hopkins and has been one of the true pioneers of how HIV replicates, where it replicates, how latency established, where the cells live. And what's fascinating and actually cool about Bob and his work is there's been a consistency of theme over the years, such that every year he kind of gives a similar talk but with updated information. So those of you who have seen him before, you'll recognize some of the talk, but there's a lot of new stuff in there. And for those of you who have never seen him talk before, this you're in for a real treat on the clarity of a lot of these basic science concepts, and you can see immediately how those concepts translate into what we do every day with patients and how we see different phenomena. So I can't think of anybody better to kick this off except for Dr. Silicano, so welcome.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you very much. Thanks to Mike and Laura for the kind invitation. I've been working on HIV in the laboratory for the last 30 years. And so for me, it's a real pleasure and honor to be able to speak to you, you all who are kind of on the front lines of the major epidemic of our time. And I'm very honored to be asked to speak to you. So I'm going to talk about efforts to find a cure for HIV infection. And if I could have the first slide, please. So I'm sure that many of your patients are interested in how close we are to a cure. And I hope that after this talk, you'll have a better sense of some of the struggles and how difficult it's going to be and the progress that has been made. I have no relevant disclosures. These are the objectives. And I'll start with this picture of the viral load over time in patients with HIV infection. And as you know, when a treatment is started, there's a very rapid drop in the level of plasma virus to below the limit of detection. But if treatment is stopped, then virus comes back very quickly. So what we're really talking about in terms of cure is how do we prevent viral rebound in somebody who goes off of treatment? Or will we ever be able to have an intervention that will allow patients to go off treatment without the virus coming back? So let's go through this these replication dynamics in a little bit more detail. Following exposure to the virus, there's a very rapid increase in the amount of virus in the blood. And this increase is exponential, meaning that it goes up not in a linear sort of 1, 2, 3 fashion, but it goes up 10, 100, 1,000. This very explosive increase in the level of virus. And we sometimes describe this in terms of R0, which is the basic reproductive ratio, meaning how many new cells get infected from each initial infected cell. And that ratio is about 10. So every infected cell is producing enough virus to infect 10 more cells, and each of those produces enough virus to infect 10 more. So you can see that it's this extremely explosive growth in virus, this exponential increase. And this concept will keep coming back. Now, when the viremia gets to a certain point, the immune response kicks in and begins to control viral replication. So viremia falls down usually to a relatively stable set point, which is different in different patients. And then when patients start in combination antiretroviral therapy, there's now an exponential decrease in viremia, and it has two phases, but it brings the viral load down to below the limit of detection of current assays. And the way to think about this is to consider that all the drugs we use to treat HIV infection act by blocking new cells from becoming infected, but they don't block a virus production by a cell that already has an integrated provirus. So this is a really a critical concept. And if you think about this, and if this block is complete, then the reason the viral load falls so quickly has to do with how long the cells that are already infected survive. And the fact that the viral load goes down very quickly means that the cells that are producing most of the virus in the blood live only a very short time in that productively infected state. And there's actually two populations, one of which, the one that produces most of the virus, those cells only live for one day in this productively infected state. And then there's another population with a half-life of about 2 weeks. If this was all we had to worry about, then the infection would be readily curable, as is the case now with hepatitis C, and I'll come back to that. That is, if the viral load kept going down at this rate. But unfortunately, it doesn't. It levels off at about one copy per mil, so below the limit of detection of clinical assays. And when this was first appreciated with very sensitive assays, this residual viremia, as we call it, there was concern that the drugs weren't effectively stopping replication, that there was still some low level of ongoing replication. There's been a big debate about this. I think most of the evidence now suggests that in an adherent patient, this is not true, that the drugs actually completely block virus replication. And probably the best evidence for this comes from studies of treatment intensification, where you add a fourth drug from a different class to patients who are doing well on treatment and measure with very sensitive assays whether this residual viremia goes down anymore. And in all of the studies, the answer is no, it doesn't. Adding a fourth drug has no effect. So basically, we will never be able to reduce viremia to below this one copy per mil because that virus is coming from cells that were infected before treatment was started, a long-lived population of cells that we call latently infected cells that have a half-life much longer than the one-day or 14-day populations that I showed you. So where do these latently infected cells come from? They actually arise as a consequence of the normal way the immune system works. So most of the CD4 cells in the body are these profoundly quiescent cells, resting cells that circulate through the body, awaiting encounter with some foreign bacteria or virus that they can recognize. And when that happens, the relevant cells become activated and proliferate. They generate these activated effector cells that participate in the immune response. And then when the response is over, most of those cells die, but some of them go back now to a resting state, and they persist as memory cells, long-lived memory cells, allowing future responses to the same infection. And this is just the fundamental way that the immune system works. Now, in HIV infection, the virus preferentially replicates in the activated cells, those red cells in the slide, and those cells die quickly, as we've said. That's why the viral load goes down so quickly when you stop new infection. HIV doesn't replicate well in resting cells, but occasionally what happens, and this is almost sort of an accident of biology, some of these activated cells become infected as they're going back to a resting memory state. And in that resting state, the HIV, the regulation of HIV gene expression is affected in such a way that the virus turns off. And that's because the HIV promoter, which controls viral gene expression, depends on host factors that are basically turned off in resting T cells. So as the cell makes this transition back to a resting state, HIV is turned off. And so now you have a stably integrated form of the virus, but it's not being expressed. And it's in a long-lived memory T cell. These memory T cells are really designed to live a long time to provide immunologic memory. And so it's almost a perfect way for the virus to persist. Basically, it's just persisting as information. It's just about 10,000 bases of DNA integrated somewhere in the human genome. And in that state, it's not seen by the immune system, and it's not affected by the drugs. But if the cell becomes activated again in the future, it can begin to produce virus. So these cells are present in everybody at a very low number, about 1 in a million, but the problem is that they have a very long half-life. So this is the half-life of this population of latently infected cells. These are patients who are doing well on treatment at Hopkins, measured over time. And you can see it's the half-life here is measured in years, not days. The decay is so slow that basically it guarantees lifetime persistence of the virus, even in people on optimal treatment. And so as a consequence, when treatment is stopped, some of these latently infected cells are becoming activated every day, and when treatment is stopped, the virus will come back. And so this is the basic fundamental problem that prevents a cure. Normally, the time to rebound is about 2 weeks. So these initial studies were published back in 1999 and 2003 with some of the older combination therapy regimens. Recently, David Margolis' group has repeated this work in patients on newer regimens, including integrase inhibitors. And the results are shown here. The half-life that he determined is basically identical to the original 44-month half-life. So what this says is that all of the enormous improvements that have been made in treatment haven't really impacted this fundamental problem of a non-replicating form of the virus that's persisting in these resting T cells. So this is what we have to deal with in terms of cure. Now, I think it's instructive to compare the situation with HIV to hepatitis C. Both viruses, there's a continuous high-level viremia, rapid viral evolution, and drug resistance with suboptimal treatment. But as you know, recent studies suggest that cure rates approaching 100% can be achieved with just 12 weeks of treatment with a two-drug regimen. So why is that? What this says is that, at least for that infection, drug therapy can be extremely effective. And one way to look at this is with a dose response curve, where you look at the amount of infection going down as you increase the concentration of the drug. And these are what curves look like. Normally, a pharmacologist will talk about the IC50, the concentration required for 50% inhibition. But there's also another important feature, which is the steepness of the curve. For some drugs, like the nucleoside analogs, they would have curves like the red curve. But other drugs, like protease inhibitors and non-nucleoside RT inhibitors, the curves are much steeper. So you can see that you go down several orders of magnitude for just a small increase in drug concentration. So these drugs can be extremely effective in stopping viral replication. And it turns out that for Hep C, you see the same kinds of very steep dose response curves that produce extremely high levels of inhibition of viral replication. For this reason, hepatitis C infection is readily curable. And of course, the big difference is hepatitis C doesn't have any latent form. So if you stop viral replication, you can cure the infection. So we really need to go after this latent form. Now, I'm sure everybody's familiar with the Berlin patient. There is one patient who has been cured, and his story is very interesting. He received bone marrow transplant for leukemia, but the donor was cleverly selected to have a mutation in CCR5, the HIV co-receptor. He received an intense conditioning regimen, developed a significant graft versus host disease, but treatment was stopped really at the time of the first transplant. He eventually required a second one, but he's remained HIV-free. No one can detect any evidence of HIV, and it's now something like 10 years after the transplant. So he is considered the first and only person cured. Now, the reason that he was cured really probably had mostly to do with graft-versus-host disease, which essentially eliminates his entire original immune system, including all of the infected cells. And if a few were left, then any virus that they produced would not be able to replicate in the new immune system that he got from this donor who had a mutation in the HIV co-receptor. Now, so far, attempts to reproduce this have failed, but there have been a couple of other interesting transplant cases. Two reported by Tim Henrich in Boston about patients with leukemia who were given transplants, but from donors who had a normal CCR5. So they received HIV-susceptible cells, and antiretroviral therapy was continued throughout the transplant period to prevent these donor cells from becoming infected. And then when there had been a near-complete replacement of the original host immune system with these donor cells, treatment was stopped. The usual rebound at 2 weeks did not occur, and people got excited. But what happened in this patient was that At 8 months, there was a sudden and dramatic rebound up to a million copies per mil. And then similarly, and presumably this was due to a few latently infected cells that were surviving, and then one of them became activated, produced virus, and then it took off. Similarly, the case of the Mississippi baby studied by my colleague at Hopkins, Debbie Prasad, this was a child who was born to an infected mother who had no prenatal care, was put on antiretroviral therapy on day one when the viral load in the baby was found to be 20,000, had a nice drop in viremia, and remained undetectable. Treatment was stopped against medical advice at 18 months, but the child remained with an undetectable viral load for over 2 years until there was, again, a sudden and dramatic rebound in viremia. And in these cases, what's interesting is that there was a little in the way of an immune response to the virus, either because of the bone marrow transplantation or early treatment. The immune response to the virus was essentially negligible. And so in the absence of an immune response and in the absence of a treatment, there's nothing to hold the virus in check and prevent that kind of explosive growth that I talked about. The only way to understand these results is to say that the virus must have been persisting in a non-replicating state, in a latent form, for years in the case of the Mississippi baby, and then it can begin to replicate. So this is what we're up against in trying to find a cure. So it's all about trying to prevent a viral rebound, and so let's take a look at that process a little bit more closely. What we know about viral rebound is when treatment is stopped is that it usually occurs on the average of 14 days after the drugs are stopped. It's exponential. In other words, the viral load goes up very, very quickly. And this probably reflects the fact that every day a small number of these latently infected cells are getting activated, and as soon as the drugs have washed out of the system, then replication can take off. You only get a long delay in rebound if you reduce the number of cells becoming reactivated to less than one per day, so that there's some delay time built in to this. And I'll show you what I mean in a second. Now, approaches to cure involve preventing rebound, and there's really a sort of two different and distinct ways that people are going about this. One is to directly attack this reservoir and reduce the number of these latently infected cells in the body. And if you reduce them all the way to zero, then it would be what we call a sterilizing cure. There's no more replication-competent virus. But what reducing the reservoir does is shift this rebound curve to the right. In other words, you get a longer and longer delay before the virus comes back. Now, there's another approach that involves enhancing the immune response so that it can better control the virus. In other words, you're not really trying to prevent rebound. You're trying to convert the patient to an elite controller so that they can control the virus, even though you haven't eliminated the reservoir. You're just allowing a better control, hopefully to below the limit of detection. And if it's a permanent reduction to below the limit of detection, this is called a functional cure. So those are two distinct approaches that we'll talk about. So I'm going to present results of some clinical trials that illustrate both of these concepts, and I'm going to focus on what is essentially one of the most exciting new developments in the cure field, and this involves what are called broadly neutralizing antibodies. These are antibodies to the surface proteins of the virus. You can see on the surface of the virus there are these spikes that are comprised of the envelope protein of the virus. This is the protein that attaches to CD4 and the co-receptor, and this is a high-resolution picture of what one of these spikes looks like. This is how the virus attaches to a CD4-positive T cell, and antibodies to this envelope spike are generated during infection, and they block a new infection of susceptible cells. But unfortunately, this is the region of the virus that mutates the most rapidly, and very quickly the virus changes the structure of this envelope spike and escapes from these neutralizing antibodies. Nevertheless, a number of laboratories have been able to find broadly neutralizing antibodies. These are antibodies that are able to recognize a large number of HIV variants. And I should have said that the fact that the virus mutates the envelope protein is really the main problem in vaccine development. Trying to induce a response that will protect against all of the variants of HIV has been extremely difficult. But some laboratories have been able to isolate antibodies, they're called broadly neutralizing antibodies, that recognize lots of different HIV variants. And so these, of course, would be of great interest for vaccine development if we could figure out a way to induce them with a vaccine. It turns out that they arise after a couple of years in most infected people, but by the time they arise, the virus in that person has already escaped from those antibodies. But if you isolate those antibodies in the laboratory and determine their sequence and then produce them, you could infuse them into other people, and they might have an effect of blocking new infection. And they also, so essentially they block new infection acting like other inhibitors of HIV entry, such as enfuvirtide or maraviroc. But they have an additional effect in that they can actually promote the killing of infected cells. This is something that antiretroviral drugs don't do. So here's one of these antibodies attaching to the envelope protein. Different broadly neutralizing antibodies attach to different sites on the envelope spike. And two of the ones I'm going to talk about are VRC01, which actually attaches to the precise place where this envelope spike contacts CD4. And another one, PGT121, which binds a different region. So these are actually have entered clinical trials in a number of cure studies. And it's interesting to think that they can act in two ways. As I mentioned, they can sort of coat the virus particle and prevent attachment of the virus to a CD4-positive T cell. But they can also promote the killing of infected cells. And the way that works is that before the virus particle buds off the surface of the infected cell, these spikes are expressed on the surface of the cell. And then if antibodies bind, they can redirect components of the immune response to kill these infected cells. And we think that one type of lymphocyte called a natural killer cell is probably the most important in this regard. So I think the thing to remember about these broadly neutralizing antibodies is that they can act essentially as entry inhibitors, but that they also have the potential to kill infected cells. So there have been a number of clinical trials, some of them shown here, that have infused these antibodies. And of course, these are proteins, so they can't be given orally. It has to be an infusion like other types of immunotherapy. These antibodies have been infused, and then treatment has been interrupted. And what people have looked for is some kind of a delay in rebound. And this is one study in which there was some delay in rebound. Most patients rebounded within a month, but a couple of them had a significant delay in rebound. Now, eventually the patients, of course, were put back on treatment after rebound occurred, and if you measure the reservoir of HIV and ask, did it change? In fact, it did not change. So the main effect is probably just an antiviral effect delaying rebound. The antibodies may have led to the killing of some productively infected cells, but the latently infected cells, there's no virus, no viral gene expression, there's no envelope protein on the cell surface, so they probably did not have an effect in this case. So to think about this a little bit more precisely, we can divide this time to rebound into three stages. First, there has to be time for the drugs to wash out of the system before the virus can begin to replicate once you stop antiretroviral therapy. And in the case of studies with broadly neutralizing antibodies, this time is much longer because these antibodies have a much longer half-life than the drugs. They can persist in the system for on the order of months, not days. So that washout period is much longer. And then you have to wait for the first latently infected cells to become activated and produce virus. Now, normally, this is happening many times a day in most patients. And then you have to wait for that virus to grow out, and that's very rapid because it's this exponential growth that I talked about. So I think the delay in rebound that has been seen in some of these broadly neutralizing antibody studies is simply due to the time required for the antibodies to wash out of the system. So I'd like to talk a little bit more in detail about the relationship between the size of the latent reservoir and the time to rebound. So this is the time to rebound in a recent treatment interruption study. Again, the average time about 2 weeks. Because antiretroviral therapy has to be lifelong, I think it's useful to sort of put this on a different time scale. So now I've just changed the time scale to years here. And you can see that viewed in this way, everybody rebounds about the same time. It's just a short time after stopping treatment. The long delays in rebound that have been reported have been in the patients who had bone marrow transplantation that I mentioned, where there was a severe reduction in the reservoir due to essentially the replacement of the host immune system by the transplant process, or the Mississippi baby in whom treatment was started so early that this reservoir hadn't really gotten established yet and there was very few latently infected cells. So this is an illustration of the concept that reducing this reservoir causes a delay in rebound. Now, how are we going to reduce the reservoir? So the main approach that people are taking is called shock and kill. And the idea is to turn the latently infected cells back on so that either by activating the T cell or then hope that the cell either dies on its own or will be killed by host effector cells such as cytolytic T cells. Now, using T cell activation is probably never going to work because it's going to cause too much activation and too much toxicity. So people have been searching for what are called latency reversing agents that would turn the virus back on without turning on every T cell in the body. And then you, of course, hope that the cell will die or be recognized by the immune system. There are a number of clinical trials going on now with various latency reversing agents, including histone deacetylase inhibitors. These are drugs that affect gene expression in a very broad sense and were originally developed as cancer drugs. There's also toll receptor agonists, and these are drugs that activate the innate immune system and in ways that are not yet clear actually seem to reverse HIV latency. And I'll just summarize what the results of these trials are. We've identified many of these latency-reversing agents in laboratory studies in various model systems, but unfortunately, when you actually take cells from patients and ask whether these drugs work, in general, they don't. So we have not yet successfully figured out a way to identify latency-reversing agents that really will work. In some of the trials, slight increases in viremia, transient blips have been observed, suggesting that the drug is turning on a few latently infected cells. But so far, there's really been no reduction in the reservoir in these trials. And that may be due to the fact that that the drugs are working and turning on latently infected cells, but the immune system is not effective in killing them. So one of the most promising studies was recently reported by Dan Brook's group. This is a study in the SIV model where they gave a latency reversing agent and also infused one of these broadly neutralizing antibodies into the animals and then stopped treatment. And the results are shown here. In the upper left are results, the rebound curves in animals that did not receive any treatment. And you can see they all rebounded and then had variable set points after a rebound. But if you gave both a broadly neutralizing antibody and a latency reversing agent, there was a pretty dramatic reduction, certainly in the set point viral load. And those results are kind of summarized here. This is percent of animals that had rebounded. And with both interventions, there really was a pretty significant effect. Now, one of the problems that I mentioned with this shock and kill approach is that the immune system may not be effectively able to kill infected cells after you turn the virus back on. And this might be due to the fact that this response is exhausted. Due to chronic immune activation, the cytolytic T cells lose their effector function. And unless treatment is started early, many of these cells are recognizing portions of the virus that have already undergone mutation, and so the virus has already escaped. So what we need is a vaccine to enhance the immune response to be given in conjunction with these latency-reversing agents, and that's also been tested in the SIV model. The results in control animals are summarized here. They all show rebound. But in animals that got both the vaccine to enhance the immune response and a latency reversing agent, there was both a delay in rebound, suggesting perhaps some reduction in the reservoir, as well as a reduction in the set point, suggesting enhanced immune control. So these are the types of studies that are going on right now. And just to close, I wanted to close on a hopeful note. Sometimes cure seems like an almost impossible goal, and people often say, you're never going to be able to do this because it just takes one latently infected cell to trigger a viral rebound. But in a mathematical modeling study done by Allison Heal, where she looked at the effect of reducing the reservoir by tenfold, 100-fold, 1,000-fold, how much of a delay in rebound would that cause? And the results are pretty interesting. She got this curve. If you don't do anything, of course, most patients rebound in 2 weeks to a month. But if you had a 1,000-fold reduction in the reservoir, which, of course, is asking a lot, and there's a lot of variation here, but on average, you would get a one-year delay in rebound. And interesting, and as I mentioned, there's tremendous variation, but there are actually, with that degree of reservoir reduction, there are some patients who would not rebound in their remaining lifespan. So essentially would be cured, would be cured even though you haven't gotten rid of every latently infected cell. The ones that remain don't reactivate in the patient's remaining lifespan. So this is kind of where we are in the cure field, and this model actually fits very well with the patients in whom a long delay in rebound has been achieved. So let me conclude. We think antiretroviral therapy does completely stop viral replication in adherent patients, but doesn't affect the latent form. Reactivating latently infected cells, that's what leads to rebound after treatment interruption. And it's not the interruption that causes the reactivation of latently infected cells. That's going on all the time, every day, at a low level. It's just that the drugs prevent that virus from replicating any further. Current efforts are focused on targeting the reservoir. Broadly neutralizing antibodies are one of the most exciting ways that this can be done. But we think that reservoir reduction will likely require reversing latency so that these cells become exposed to the antibodies or to other immune interventions. And long delays in rebound will require something like a 1,000-fold reduction in the reservoir, which is, of course, asking a lot, but will not require elimination of every latently infected cell. So I'll stop there, and you want me to take some questions?
Okay. Thanks very much, Bob.
So earlier this morning, we talked a bit about the reservoir, so I think everything you said just reinforced what we had been discussing. I might add that some questions that came up on the cards weren't asked, often because we knew we'd be getting to those topics later. So if you sit on a question, we held back. Before we get to the question, I just want to reemphasize one point just to get your comment, and that is you did a great job of showing how the, let's call them the Boston patients and the Mississippi baby, but let's focus on the Boston patients who didn't quite get all their reservoir eliminated through the conditioning of transplant and few cells remained, and then they rebounded. One thing that is different among a lot of patients who are in that situation, or even those who get treated early in acute infection, ordinarily, if you don't have those situations and you treat someone, just a chronically infected person, they come down and you stop therapy, 14 days later they rebound. What's fascinating is that the viral load usually settles at about the same set point. And in the cases of the Boston patients and those acutely infected, those folks are almost like having an acute infection over again. You might want to comment on why you think that is.
Yeah, so in those patients, it's essentially like you're dealing with an entirely new immune system that essentially hasn't seen the virus before. So, in fact, you are replacing, in the case of bone marrow transplantation, when there is complete replacement of the host immune system, you are starting over again.
Right.
So it is essentially like an acute infection.
Yeah, and then the those who have seen it before, the immune system is ready and already has reached that equilibrium, and so it comes back. Let's start with Steve over there.
Hello. Yep, there we go. Steve Johnson from the University of Colorado. Just a practical question about the patient with persistently detectable low viral loads like 63, 47, and so on. We talk about adherence. We talk about release from the latent reservoir, talk about laboratory error. Are there other things that we should think about, and is there any relationship with that patient with what their initial viral load was, for example, higher viremia?
Well, this is a great question. In principle, all of the things you mentioned could be going on. If adherence has been ruled out, then it's possible that in a patient who has a very large reservoir, and many of those patients may have had very high viral load initially or been infected for a long time before treatment, that the number of latently infected cells that activate every day is sufficient to give you a viral load above 50 copies per mil, but there is no new infection events because of the drugs. And so how do you know? Well, the way that it's been done, in laboratory studies and in clinical studies, one thing is intensification. If additional drugs don't, and all of the intensification studies were done with lots of different types of drugs, there has not been a reduction in this residual viremia. So if that's the case, then low but detectable viral load is probably not due to ongoing replication. It's due to a large reservoir. The other key thing, of course, to look for is viral evolution. And this is the other big argument that the drugs can completely stop replication is that if you look for viral evolution, which we know and all of you know from all of the years of taking care of patients with drug resistance, that the virus very quickly evolves in the setting of suboptimal treatment. But in analysis of the residual viremia in adherent patients, what you see essentially is no evolution. You see exactly the same sequence that was there 10 years ago, not even a single base change. So it's the lack of evolution and the failure of intensification to change things that I think indicates, at least in a theoretical sense, that that this is not due to ongoing replication. But, of course, in individual patients, you have to ensure that it's not an adherence issue.
Okay. Jeff?
Hi. Jeff Bosner, UCLA. I have a question about you mentioned CTL exhaustion as one of the barriers to immune control. So are there studies looking at reversals of that, like checkpoint inhibitors that are used in other diseases that could be utilized to reverse that?
Yeah, so that's a great point. There are studies of antibodies to a protein called PD-1 that's expressed on the surface of cells that have this so-called exhausted. They're in this so-called exhausted state as well as a CTLA-4. These are both proteins that are induced in activated T cells and help to control a normal immune response. But in the setting of chronic infection, they're evident of cells that don't function well. And antibodies to those proteins can essentially reverse this exhausted state. It's been very successful in some forms of cancer, enhancing tumor-specific immunity. In HIV, I think there are clinical trials. Mike may know more about this, but So far, I don't think the results are particularly promising, and I think, these also have significant side effects that don't obviously have to be weighed against just taking, one pill once a day. So,
hi, Gary Spinner from Southwest Community Health Center. In the macaque study that you referenced that received the TLR7 agonist and the broadly neutralizing antibodies, are there some macaques that have still yet to rebound? And if so, would you consider that those have been cured?
Well, in some of the macaque studies, that is the case. And the problem is that in that model system, actually what was used was a hybrid between simian immunodeficiency virus and HIV, in which the HIV envelope protein was inserted into the SIV genome to create a sort of a hybrid virus that really is not as pathogenic and doesn't replicate as well as HIV. And in some animals who were just infected with, it's called SHIV, this hybrid virus, the virus replicates and then viremia is controlled spontaneously. So it's a little bit hard to interpret the failure or the absence of rebound in those monkey models because often, in, at least in some cases, the virus is controlled normally. Now, of course, the studies all have a control group, but usually because of the expense of these studies and so forth, the control group is just a couple of animals, and so it's a little bit hard to say. I think what you say has been observed, but whether it's a real cure, I think people are a little reluctant to say at this point.
Thank you. Just got a few minutes left. We'll try to get these.
Yeah, Bruce Williams from the University of New Mexico. I guess the question I would have is we experience an aging population in HIV care. As we start to introduce vaccines, for example, that might elicit a broadly neutralizing response, would we be placing patients at risk for a rebound as their immune senescence sort of kicks in and they're unable to mount that antibody response as effectively as they might have earlier on?
Well, it's a good point. I think we first of all, right now, don't have a good way to induce these broadly neutralizing antibodies. It turns out if you look at their structure, they're highly unusual, and they've evolved over a long period of time of sort of the virus mutating and the immune response trying to catch up. And so they have an unusual structure. Right now, we don't have a way to induce them with a vaccine. Most of the vaccine efforts are focused on cytotoxic T-cell responses. And I think you're right. They may work less well in an aging patient population.
Steve Pelton from Boston. Are there other reservoirs besides resting T cells?
Yeah, so people always ask me this. The one that we know about and that we can demonstrate in every patient by just taking a blood sample is resting CD4 cells. The other main cell type that's been implicated are macrophages, which certainly are infected. I think the problem is we don't know whether an infected macrophage can survive on a time scale of years the way a memory T cell can, and that's hard to study because, first of all, the macrophages are in tissues, so we can't get at them. In the SIV model, most of the experiments are conducted within a time scale of a year, so we don't really have that long-term data. But it's certainly possible, and it would just make the situation that much more difficult, I think.
So I have some questions from the audience. The first one is written on a Dear Santa note. I love that. Got it from the atrium. So if you want some of these, they're welcome. And at the end it says, can Santa bring this person something good for Christmas? Yes, he can. So the question is basically about the shock and awe approach and that it's not working real well, that it's sort of only 5% of the reservoir cells that get eliminated. So do you see this as a long-term strategy that can work?
Yeah, I think, you know, people got discouraged about this because the initial trials were negative. On the other hand, it's a logical approach that makes sense. You know, we know this is the problem. We can't get at these cells unless we turn them on so that they become identifiable, and then the immune system can hopefully eliminate them. I think the hardest part is how do you turn on the virus in a resting T cell when most of the sort of transcriptional machinery that the virus needs to turn on is not there. Now, you know, the other approaches are just trying to enhance the immune response so that you can prevent the virus from rebounding even if the latently infected cells are still there. A lot of people think that's much more likely to work, but You know, we've been doing therapeutic vaccination for many years, and so far there's essentially no success. So hard to say which
right.
will work.
So we're out of time, but I think there's a few I can ask real quick for very fast, almost yes-no answers. And that is, do you ever see TAT or TAR as regulatory proteins being an approach to treat the reservoir in any kind of way?
Yes, that's a great question. TAT is a viral protein that upregulates HIV gene expression. If we could figure out a way to introduce TAT into all of the cells in the body, we would be able to. That would probably be the best latency reversing agent that we could come up with. But of course, it's a protein. It's hard to get it into cells.
Okay. What about antibody penetration into CSF, CNS?
Good question. It's probably not very good. There are sort of new engineered forms of antibodies that are a lot smaller and might penetrate better.
Are the viral species that return after stopping therapy as pathogenic or the same virulence as the ones before treatment?
Hasn't really been studied, but presumed to be the same.
Yeah. Okay, and then I'll finish with this one. I think you've said this, but it's probably worth reiterating because it's a key point of the talk, is if low-level viremia is happening in the setting of therapy, where does that virus come from? I know you said it, but it's probably worth reiterating.
Yeah, we don't know. These latently infected cells are present all over the body, in the lymph nodes, the spleen, the gut, and the periodic activation of a small number of these cells is what likely gives rise to the residual viremia. But it's very hard to say exactly where it's come from.
Yeah. So I think we're out of time. Thank you
so
much.
Thank you.
All right. Wonderful.